then we make this transition now to New York and to the Lennergren Foundation for Anthropological Research, and we'll have two presentations concerning this. And the first one on the history of the foundation will be given by Professor Seidel Silverman, who was former president of this foundation.
Well, the conference is about reality and myth, so we have to begin with our myth. And this has to do with the relationship between these two extraordinary men who were in the source of our foundation, Axel Lennergren, of course, and Paul Fejös. Paul Fejös was a Hungarian trained as a medical doctor who came to the United States in the 1920s and had a totally different career as a film director in Hollywood, and quite acclaimed as a film director. He then moved from Hollywood movies into exploration and ethnographic filmmaking, became an amateur archaeologist and explorer who had no formal training, and then had this encounter with Mr. Lennergren. The myth that we all live with is that the two men met in Singapore when Fejös was making a film and Axel visited the set. So the story goes that Fejös accompanied him on a tiger hunt, and at a critical moment, as the tiger was charging, Axel raised his gun and then froze, and Paul stepped in and shot the tiger. In gratitude, Axel awarded him a foundation to support his pet interests. Now, Ilya has found the source of this myth, which had to do with a panther on a movie set that got out of its cage. But nevertheless, what we have here is what anthropologists call origin myths, and this is the origin myth of our foundation. Now, the foundation was established by Lennergren in February of 1941 as the Viking Fund. And in the first year of its existence, Lennergren was the first president and chairman of the board, but he soon stepped down in favor of his American lawyer, Richard Carney Hunt. Later that year, Lennergren asked to resign from the board because he felt that under the circumstances it was best for all the board members to be American citizens. During that first year, most of the grants were made at Lennergren's own request, and they ranged around his various interests, including, of course, the funding for the expedition to Peru, which was being conducted by Fejös. It also included an award to the University of Kentucky to establish an aeronautical research laboratory, an award to the University of Toronto for geophysical research, a fair amount of money to the American Red Cross, funds for publication exchange with Latin America. So the funding was all over the place. In December of 1941, Fejös returned to New York from the Peruvian expedition, and at that time, Lennergren asked him to take over the scientific work of the Viking Fund. Fejös then had a series of conversations with Axel in which he gradually persuaded him that the happenstance funding here and there was not going to add up to a great deal, and it was better to concentrate upon one particular mission. And he suggested this small new field of anthropology, which was poorly supported. There were many anthropologists around and very little money. And Winogrand agreed. The clinching argument was that Fayoche appealed to Winogrand's aspirations to be an international statesman by persuading him that anthropology was positioned to become a medium of international understanding. At the end of 1941, as we know, Winogrand left the U.S. He was shortly blacklisted, and Fayoche became effectively the manager of the Viking Fund. In our own history, the board of directors has always held an oversight role. And the role of managing the finances. They had formal approval of all of the awards, but they never were directly involved in the choice of awards. Once the foundation became directed to the professional field of anthropology, it was Fayoche, together with his various professional anthropologist advisors, who made all the choices. And that separation between the board and the professional anthropologists has been maintained over the years to a very beneficial effect. Later in our history, as the number of applications and activities grew, the process of review of applications became formalized. And it became a very well-respected a system for selecting projects of merit. Now, let me just say a word about what anthropology is. In general, it's a cover term that includes a wide range of activities investigations having to do with the origins of the human species, beginning with the primate past, into the history of humans and the history of human cultures through studies of the past, into the study of the range of humans today, their biological diversity, and their social and cultural behavior, the study of humans really in all times and places. It seems like a very large agenda, but in fact, in the United States, under the influence of Franz Boas, anthropology developed with four defined subfields. Biological or physical anthropology, which studied human evolution and human diversity. Archaeology, as distinct from classical archaeology, the anthropological archaeologists were interested in the whole history of the human experience. Anthropological linguistics, and again, as opposed to formal linguistics, philologists of that type of linguistics, anthropological linguists were interested in all human languages, most of them unwritten and unknown to the historical record. And finally, the whole study of human behavior in the social and cultural context, sometimes called social anthropology, sometimes called ethnology, sometimes called ethnography. It gets a little bit complicated as we look around the world, because each country tends to have their own definitions of each of these subfields. But the Viking Fund from the beginning and the Winogrand Foundation throughout its history was dedicated to the support of anthropology internationally in all of its branches. So it doesn't really matter what it was called in different countries, it was recognized as part of this discipline. So in 1942, when Fayose took active control of the scientific work, the war had just broken out. The war years were a time when not very much could be done. Fayose occupied two small rooms in Rockefeller Center, and he talked about spending his days in the office when nobody came. Partly because most anthropologists were involved in the war effort, were taken away from their own research, and also because there was a great deal of suspicion because of the blacklisted founder. Still, a few things did get started, and Fayose himself was away teaching for the war effort at Stanford, the grants were sort of happenstance, and a great deal of funding went to agencies involved in the war effort. Now, everything changed in 1945. People came back from war. Anthropology itself began a period of expansion from being a discipline where basically the whole American field could fit into this room. The returning veterans began to populate the universities, and under the GI Bill in the United States, a large number of these veterans became anthropologists, beginning the new post-war expansion. Fayose began to make grants. Most of them were small. But I just want to mention two grants that he made in this critical transitional year of 1945. One of them was to Helmut de Terra for research in Mexico. Fayose himself became involved in it because he suggested to de Terra that a certain geophysicist he knew had a method for locating buried materials. And de Terra used that method and in the process discovered Tepechpan Man, which was then the earliest known human find in the Americas. A second major award went to a dear friend of mine, Hortense Powdermaker, who did the first and only field study, anthropological field study of Hollywood. Wrote a very interesting book on how Hollywood works from the perspective of an anthropologist. And Fayose himself, because of his own Hollywood history, was very much interested in that project. In 1945, Fayose acquired a townhouse on 71st Street near Fifth Avenue, a very elegant townhouse which still stands today. This changed everything. It allowed the rapid expansion of activities. It had research laboratories, had a large collection of technical equipment which was available for loan, had a library, had space for visiting scholars. And among other things, Fayose began use the house for supper conferences, which were very elegant dinner evenings, at which every known visiting anthropologist spoke. And a number of very important events took place at the house. Essentially, the house allowed the Viking Fund to develop as a kind of research institute, not only giving grants to scientists to conduct their own work, but also carrying out a number of activities in-house. He began to devise other programs. The Viking Fund summer seminars in physical anthropology became extremely important in the transition of that field from what we now call the old physical anthropology, which had to do with typology and a rather static approach to human diversity, to the new physical anthropology, which drew on population genetics and a much more dynamic kind of interest in human evolution and diversity. There were grants to a number of projects. The Vero Valley project of the Institute of Andean Research was another project in Peru. An interesting series of grants were made to the philosopher F.S.C. Northrop, who ran a program on intercultural relations and law at the Yale School of Law. And this program, the work of that program, became a part of the 1948 United Nations International Convention on Genocide. At that time, the Viking Fund Medal was also introduced, which became anthropology's closest equivalent to the Nobel Prize, awarding distinguished anthropologists the prize every year, always accompanied by a very lavish formal dinner with everyone in formal dress and swilling the champagne. So the programs were expanding, and in those first 5 years after the war, about 300 grants were awarded. I want to talk about one particular activity because it illustrates the way Fayose used his funds, combined them with personal contacts, his own encyclopedic knowledge, his own sense of instinct about people and projects to accomplish a great deal with not very much money. This has to do with the development of carbon 14. Now, the story is that, and this is not myth, this is all in the realm of reality. In 1947, Fayose learned that the Dutch paleoanthropologist Ralph von Koenigswald, who was thought to have died in the war, had actually survived in a concentration camp. He was from Java. And amazingly, all of his hominid fossils had also survived because he had hidden them before the arrival of the Japanese. Fayose decided that he needed to be brought to the United States, and he arranged to bring him and his family to New York, where he established him in the rooms at the upper level of the house. Now, it happened that this was a beastly hot summer, and von Koenigswald begged him to try to find him a place outside of the city where they could survive the summer. So Fayose made a few calls, and he arranged for the family to have a bungalow at the Cold Spring Harbor Research Center on Long Island, which was then a very important center for scientific studies. Von Koenigswald felt very much out of place there. Nobody knew what paleoanthropology was. But it happened that his fossil of Soto Man had appeared on the cover of Life magazine. And one day at lunch, one of the scientists came by and said, tell me, how old is your fossil? And von Koenigswald said, 500,000 years, more or less. I can't tell you precisely. And the scientist said to him, well, it's too bad it weren't a little younger, because then I could have given you the exact date. Now, von Koenigswald was very perplexed by this conversation, and he called Fayose. Fayose quickly learned that the scientist in question was Harold Urey, who's one of the great nuclear scientists, and he realized that he had been talking about radium emanation. Fayose then made a quick call to the anthropologist Ralph Linton at Columbia University. Everything was done through personal connections, and asked if he could arrange for him to be introduced to Urey, who was then at Columbia. And Linton said, well, as it happened, Urey has this very day left for Chicago, where he's going to join the University of Chicago, and it's too late, I can't introduce you. Well, Fayose collected von Koenigswald, and the next morning took an airplane to Chicago and arrived at the train station as Urey got off the train and told him of their interest in his work. Urey said that this was actually the work of a young assistant, a chemist named Willard Libby. So the two of them immediately contacted Libby, and Fayose begged him to accept $25,000 for his research. He had called Hunt for approval, and Hunt, of course, gave it. Libby himself thought this was all premature, but he reluctantly accepted. Then in January of 1948, he came to the house in New York and at a summer conference reported on his work. He was greeted with a stony silence. The archaeologists were extremely skeptical. Still, they began to send him samples, and they sent him samples that had no dates, and each time he was able to independently provide the correct date. There was one exception, a collection of artifacts from Egypt that were sent from the University of Pennsylvania had a wood sample which just didn't figure. It was came out a much younger date. And Livy was terribly upset by this until Fayose found out that the archaeologist at Penn had taken a piece of wood off the packing crate and had thrown it in order to trip him up. So this kind of authenticated his reputation, and carbon 14 rapidly became a keystone of modern archaeology, and Libby won the Nobel Prize for this work in 1960. So this was the kind of thing that could be done with a little bit of money. Now, by this point, by the beginning of the 50s, the whole set of principles by which the foundation operated ever after was established. The commitment to the discipline of anthropology in all of its branches internationally, and the close relationship between the foundation and the discipline, which allowed rapid response to promising new developments and responding to the needs of the discipline as the scholars themselves saw it. Now, this is a novel way of running a foundation. Most foundations set the agenda, tell the scientists what they are interested in funding, and then the scientists write up their grants to match what they think they can get money for. But as Fayose established it, that was the wrong way to do it. He was looking for what was actually happening within the discipline and supporting the best work as it was turning out, rather than dictating a separate agenda. The emphasis on basic research, which became a very risky kind of endeavor. It's very difficult to raise money for basic research because most donors want to solve problems and give money to something that can be have a direct effect. But our approach has always been to put our money on basic research, which often turned out to be problem solving in the end. The worldwide scope, and especially the commitment to promoting anthropology as an international discipline. The policy of making grants to individuals, many of whom had no institutional affiliation but had professional qualifications, also unusual in the world of grant making who prefer dealing with institutions. The practice of favoring small grants, some small sums of money strategically placed, and requiring a minimum of bureaucratic detail. Later on, some of this had to give way, but the belief was that money was given to the scientist and his or her scientific integrity was depended upon, and detailed accounting for expenditures was inappropriate. Now, so these were the principles that were really established by the beginning of the 50s when the Viking Fund became the Winter Grant Foundation. It was in honor of the founder's 70th birthday, and Rofter been known as the Winter Grant Foundation for Anthropological Research. Now, in the 1950s, the programs all continued. The small grants continued, and I'll mention two of them. One, in 1952, a grant of $4,000 was made to Louis Leakey to buy a vehicle for his explorations at Olduvai Gorge. He was having difficulty using his full time because he didn't have any means of bringing water to the site. The vehicle could carry water, and it made all the difference in the work. And Fayosh's principle from the beginning was to find needs that were not being met by other funders and to fill those spaces where the difference could be made. As a result of that, Mary Leakey discovered Zinjanthropus, a very important hominid find, and then the National Geographic Society became long-term funders. Another grant was made to bring the Jesuit paleontologist Teilhard de Chardin from France, where he was being, his church superiors were disciplining him for his heretical views on human evolution. So Fayosh brought him to New York, established him in the house, and for the next few years gave him annual study grants, and he completed many important works. Well, during the 50s, the board began to be concerned that the small grants were not really going to be that important in this new world where great public foundations were established. The National Science Foundation was established, and the private foundations were supporting some anthropology. So with Fayosh, of course, leading them, they decided to focus on the single most important task that they saw that the foundation could fulfill, and that was to promote communication and collaboration among scholars internationally to encourage the growth of anthropology as a worldwide science. Now, this was done with two major initiatives. One was to expand upon the foundation's history of sponsoring conferences and symposia by creating a European conference center. And in 1957, Wintergreen purchased the castle of Burg Bartenstein outside of Vienna, which had been the hunting lodge of Prince Liechtenstein. And this would become the foundation's European conference center. It said that Fayosh insisted that they have a site from which he could see Hungary. Axel paid $25,000 for it, and that was the only money that was ever added to the endowment from the beginning. The foundation has always lived off of the earnings of the endowment, sometimes exceeding the spending limit, which is more or less around 5%, but rarely really dipping substantially into the endowment itself, and that has really saved us financially. Now, the Burg Bartenstein, then, from its beginning in 1958 until it was closed in 1980, became an incredibly important conference center. 86 international symposia were held there, and most of them, I venture to say, became important for the development of the discipline. And it developed a particular model of conference management, which is, has proved really quite unique. The second initiative was the creation of the journal Current Anthropology. Now, this wasn't just an ordinary journal. In 1957, Fayosh asked Sol Tax, an anthropologist from the University of Chicago, to undertake a survey of anthropologists worldwide to find out what would benefit them most in terms of creating an international community of scholars. The result was that this journal, which was not a matter of readers, subscribers, but rather associates. Any professional anthropologist would become an associate and became an active participant in the work of in putting the journal together and the reviews, and particularly in the contribution to what became a known as the CA treatment. That was the practice of publishing the research paper together with commentaries. They all appeared together and then a reply from the author. This was then copied by a number of other journals, but it began there. And the journal was also a forum for discussion and debate and a clearinghouse of information. The foundation subsidized the journal to allow it to be distributed all over the world, and for many years it was the only journal that was accessible to scholars in a number of different countries. Around the 1960s, these were the glory days. The discipline was growing very fast, and the foundation's funds were growing. By the end of the 1960s, a $2 million endowment had become $20 million, and the programs were all thriving. Now, Faosch died in 1963, and he was succeeded by his wife, who had been his associate, Lita Faosch, who soon became Lita Osmundson. In the 1960s, the conference program, the grant program, all expanded. New programs were devised. Of particular interest was the development of the casting program. Winogrand had funded a scientist who was developing an innovative methodology for making plastic casts of fossils, human and primate remains. And this became the production of casts that became an important resource for scholars and for teaching all over the world. Other activities were introduced, and everybody was doing great. Well, at the end of the 60s, the tax laws changed, and the new tax law of 1969 imposed a number of restrictions. It was necessary to divest of Electrolux stock and to diversify the investments. The accounting procedures became much more strict. There were spending requirements which imposed certain limits on spending. The foundation had to change from being a kind of personalized benevolent donor and patron of the discipline to becoming a more routinized operating foundation. Now, in the 70s, the dark clouds gathered, a number of forces. Inflation was rising, the investment climate was poor, bad choice had been made in the choice of the investment manager. The value of the dollar eroded, meaning that Burke-Bachenstein became much more expensive. The foundation reached its low point in 1974 when the endowment was $15 million. I haven't tried to equate any of this to current funds, but you get the idea of the ups and downs. The question then became how long the foundation could continue to function. It was spending more than its 5% limit because of the cost of maintaining the house and the castle, as well as all the programs. And the board decided to close down a number of programs. The casting program was terminated. The Viking Fund publications in anthropology were terminated. The Viking Fund medals came to an end, and so on. But the larger debate within the board was whether the foundation should spend itself out of existence. And this was a real debate. One member of the board argued for generational justice, meaning that it was the obligation of the board to maintain the foundation for future generations. But in order to do this, a lot of things had to be economized, and above all, both the house and the castle had to be sold. And this unhappy turn of events happened in about 1979-1980. The foundation moved into rental offices. Burke-Bartenstein became private summer residence of the same gentleman who bought the house in New York. Everybody was very unhappy. The anthropologists outside were extremely concerned because of the close relationship between the foundation and the discipline. People, our colleagues followed every development, and they felt keenly the loss of Bert Vartenstein. So there was a great deal of suspicion and hostility on all sides. Still, it's important to remember that during the decade of the 70s, at this crisis time, almost 1,000 grants were awarded. So the basic work of the foundation continued. 10 years of symposia produced some extremely important events. Okay, with the 1980s, the foundation was no longer a research institute. The loss of the house meant the loss of all of the programs that had been sustained by a physical facility. Lita did her best to maintain the Bert Vartenstein model at different conference centers and hotels, but she never was satisfied that anything could approach Bert Vartenstein. I do want to mention, though, that with these changes, with hard times, in a way the foundation became more democratic. Both the house and the castle were wonderful, elegant places, and invitations to them were extremely prized. There was a great deal of suspicion that there were certain members of the discipline who got invitations, but not everybody did. Also, because Lita was not an anthropologist herself, she relied on a circle of advisors, and it was felt that this was not inclusive, particularly of the new voices in the discipline, women, minorities, the younger generation. With the 1980s, as the new tax laws required more systematic procedures, and as the foundation became much more of a grant-making than an in-house operation, it also became more open. So it was not entirely a negative development. And one very important program was undertaken under Lita in the early 80s, and this was the Developing Countries Training Fellowship, which was a program to allow students from third world countries to find training anywhere in the world where they could get professional training. Began modestly, but very soon there were at least 20 fellows being supported in at any time, and that did exist. Now, the board itself was changing. The early board had some of the Electrolux people on it, had people who had been there from the beginning, who had very fond personal relationships with Paul Fairish and Lita. Now there were the addition of a number of younger members of the board who were very impatient with the personal style of the foundation. They had ambitions to become more of a rationalized management. They wanted a harder kind of science than the kind of what they perceived as the vagaries of anthropological research. The board was no longer a leisurely social affair, but became businesslike and contentious. Now, all of this led to the decision to replace Lita Osmundson, and in the end, a search committee was established which had academics on it, because I don't know if I mentioned that the board itself never had anthropologists on it by design, because it was always felt that that would be perceived as favoring certain kinds of work. But in the beginning of the 80s, an advisory council was created, and that's why initially six anthropologists on it, and they became a kind of communication medium between the foundation and the discipline. So the advisory council played a role and ensured that instead of a tough business manager to lead the foundation, that they would have a professional anthropologist. The result of the search was that I was appointed, and I came in 1987, and I underwent a process of revitalizing programs, repairing bad feelings, and generally working with now a very friendly and helpful board to reconstruct the foundations of glory days. It was helped by the fact that we now had very good professional investment people on our board, which we have a representative today, and they quickly brought the foundation back to where it had been at its high. And in 1990, the endowment stood at $50 million. By the end of the decade, it was over $100 million. So having more money also helped in supporting good work and building good feelings. Well, I would just skip over the 90s because we're coming into the foundation today, which Leslie will follow up on. But to summarize, the first 60 years of the foundation, between its founding as the Viking Fund and my retirement in 2000, the foundation had awarded over 5,000 grants. Each one of those grants produced numerous publications, and we do have a record of the publications. This had an inestimable impact on the development of all branches of anthropology. The Winter Grant Foundation for anthropological research is really the only foundation that was devoted exclusively to anthropology internationally, and it became an extremely important factor in the development of the discipline. Several hundred symposia and conferences over these years produced work of incalculable importance, and I counted at least 100 that in retrospect could be said to have actually changed the direction of different fields. So the foundation's history survived very nicely into the 21st century, and to bring you up to the foundation today, I pass you on to the current president, Leslie Aiello.